Sandwards Tate Ministry, Queensland. This is now cassette number 5 on Thursday, the 19th of July, 1984. And we're at the St. John's College for the Provincial Conference of the Mothers' Union. Guest speaker, of course, is Dr. Lois Anderson. And her subject this morning is, How Do I Relate to Others? Dr. Lois Anderson.
We are doing session 3, which is reaching out to others. And this is a huge canvas. I cannot possibly cover a fraction of what is involved in learning to love. But at least we'll look at some things and maybe we'll all learn together. Now, we come across this sort of thing in the Bible all the time. As I have loved you, so love one another. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul and strength, and your neighbour as yourself. On these hang all the law and the prophets. By this shall all men know that you are my disciples, because of the love you have one for the other. And just think of these words that you've heard again and again, probably like I have, so often that your mind almost switches off when you hear them. But listen to what you're really saying. I'm reading the first few verses in 1 Corinthians 13, which follows a chapter describing Paul's model of the church as a body and every member being given various gifts. And in the beginning of chapter 13, he talks about some of these gifts. He says, though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels and have not love, I am become as a sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal. Though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I could remove mountains and have not love, I am nothing. Have you ever really sat down and thought about that before? All the things that we tend to aim after are nothing unless we have love. And though I give all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned and have not love, it profiteth me nothing. Now, how do we learn to love? Because there's no doubt that this is the prime command, the command which dominates the New Testament. As we said before, it is the hammer beat. And it is a command. When I was learning Greek, I became fascinated with stumbling through some of the New Testament. I made the discovery that most of these statements about loving one another were in the imperative case. That is, they were a command. And I suddenly said to my husband, look, this is psychologically unreal. You can't switch on a button and love people. Love happens to you. You can't create it. What's this about? This is an impossible command. He said, well, that's what it says. So I started a search of really trying to come to grips with what this love was. Obviously it wasn't just an emotion as we know it. What were the ingredients of this love which we are told to give to our neighbour? And that's what we want to look at a little this morning, and why I gave you the passages in Ephesians to dig into. Do we get some clues about the ingredients of love? Now, as we look at Ephesians chapters 4 and 5 and these passages you've been working with, I wonder if anything struck you as rather startling about verses 1 and 2. Because in the first three chapters, as I said earlier, we had our eyes opened to the exhilarating and awesome picture of the status and resources of a Christian. We were given a position of high status and high responsibility with the bestowal of power. And so in verse 1, we are urged to walk worthy of our calling. And that seems fitting. In our world, we would have a position of dignity and honour and power. But what are we told? The first thing, to live in lowliness and meekness. Now, did that seem to you startling? Lowliness and meekness are words we don't use in our language anymore. And often they're translated as humility, gentleness and patience. Now this is radically different from the pattern we know in our world, and it was radically different from the pattern they knew in the Greek world. These weren't qualities admired by the Greeks, and they're not qualities admired in our world. How do we understand this? What does it mean? Now, Moll, in his commentary on Philippians, said something which really gripped my attention. I hadn't thought about this before. It shows a little light. He says, the power the Holy Spirit gives, and which we all crave for, is not like the world's power, not visibly striking and impressive, but is peaceable and gentle. My California students, when they were wrestling with this, and they had more time, they spent a week searching through Ephesians and digging into the questions of self-identity and self-worth as a Christian. And after really reveling in the first three chapters, they came to this part and they were startled and they were really wrestling with it, and they said, I wonder, we've been given a real sense of a value in these first three chapters. Our eyes have been opened to the value of myself as a Christian and the exhilaration and the wonder of it. Does this mean that true humility can only come after the development of a true sense of self-worth? This was a very vital and interesting thought. And we found that Chrysostom, one of the early Christian fathers and great thinkers, said the same. Humility presupposes a man's consciousness of being something great. But the strongest light comes from Jesus himself, because it is the opinion of scholars that Paul here is quoting from Jesus himself. Lowliness and meekness are the phrases that Jesus uses in describing himself. If you remember in the Gospel this morning, Matthew 11, come unto me, all ye that labour and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am meek and lowly of heart, and you shall find rest unto your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Now, how does Jesus express humility? By going around belittling himself? Someone notes that Jesus wholly knew himself and was completely in harmony with himself. With absolute authority, he could say, before Abraham was, I am, John 8. I and the Father are one, John 10. And it's interesting to note that in the New Testament, statements regarding Christ's identity precede statements concerning his self-denial. Before Jesus washed his disciples' feet, there was a majestic declaration of his total self-acceptance. Jesus knew that his Father had given everything into his hands, and that he had come from God and was going to God. And in Philippians 2, that oft-quoted wonderful passage, let this mind be in you, which was in Christ Jesus, who being the very nature of God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped at, but emptied himself and took on the form of a servant and the likeness of man, and humbled himself and became obedient even unto death. You may say, oh, that's easy for Jesus, but he was God. What about me? But Paul says this, your attitude should be the same as that of Christ Jesus. Let this mind be in you. In other words, true humility is real self-giving, self-offering. A strong sense of identity and calling and worth that leads to self-giving and self-forgetfulness. And Jesus is our model. Now, I don't know whether any of you had time to play around with those self-charts, but if you get them out, I'm sure you did it all. If you get them out now, we'll look at them for a moment. Now, just look at... As part of my own private search into the confusion of apparently contradictory scriptural passages about self-worth and humility and the whole muddle that we get in, and I realised that self is spoken of in the Bible in many different ways, and this is why we get confused. And if we look at those four columns, self-centeredness, self-rejection, self-acceptance, and self-giving. Self-centeredness is something which we all have to struggle with as a fallen human being. And you know that inner self-absorption, selfishness, self-importance, what I call me-firstism, the desire to be admired, to be the best, our hatred of criticism, our sensitivity to anything which threatens our own self-image. That is something which Christ died to try and deal with. But we will be fallen man until we're in the glory. And although the Holy Spirit is working in that, we're all still conscious of that inner thrust which we hate. And some people get so discouraged about this that they go into the way of self-rejection, and they feel that Christian humility is to belittle oneself and always be conscious of all the things within that are wrong. And that leads to self-hate and even sometimes to self-annihilation, which we saw with Professor Cook, where he said he felt that everything that was really me was being crushed. But I hope we've got some glimmer through these studies in Ephesians of the transformation that happens and occurs when a person becomes a child of God. and the legitimate sense of self-worth and value that we are given, both instantly as our status is changed and many things are altered and we are chosen of God, redeemed, forgiven, loved. But also because we are being changed and we are growing into something that in God's hands will become beautiful. And perhaps the most vivid expression of that is found in the Song of Mary, the mother of Jesus, when she said, "From now on all generations shall call me blessed, for the Mighty One has done great things in me." The direction, the sense of direction from there is towards self-giving, self-forgetfulness, which is the opposite of self-centeredness. And that is the quality of true humility. Now, before we go on, seeing that we're also looking into leadership this week, you'll be intrigued to notice that Jesus also in his teachings talks about leadership in Mark 10. In the context where James and John had demanded a seat to the right and left of him in his kingdom, and the other disciples were very irate and indignant. And Jesus questioned whether they were ready for this, but also he said it wasn't his to give. And he said, "You know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many." That's our model of leadership. Now we'll look at another thing you were digging into this morning. Bearing one another in love. What does this mean? The commentators suggest that it's linked with bearing one another's burdens in Galatians 6 and so fulfilling the life of Christ, which is to love one another. And they talk of mutual love, which consists in the acceptance of one's neighbour, including the load on his shoulder. And love reigns where the troubles and bliss of one's neighbour weigh more heavily than one's own peace of mind. And we say, "Oh, yes," but we don't do it. How do we learn to do it? Because you admit, and I admit, that our own troubles loom much larger in our hearts and lives than those of our neighbour. And as for our neighbour's joys, someone made the penetrating comment, "We're told to weep with those that weep," and maybe we can do that. But to rejoice with those that rejoice, that's much harder. How do you feel when your neighbour's child gets a T score of 990 and yours doesn't make it? How do we feel about our neighbour's children and our own? We're just gripped with comparison and competition. We're not gripped with joy in rejoicing with our neighbour's successes. I'd like to link that admonition, bearing one another in love, with the comments on love later in the passage. Be towards one another generous, warm-hearted. And this is a little different from yours because I've gone to the straight Greek because it gets down to the clue, which is instead of saying forgiving one another, which many of the translations use because we modern people don't know what grace means, but we do. And the Greek says showing grace to each other. Just as God in Christ showed grace to you. So be imitators of God as children who are loved by him. And walk in love just as Christ loved us and gave himself for us, submitting to one another because you stand in awe of Christ. Here we're getting back to the same thing. We know from our studies that grace is God's unmerited, unconditional love. That we're accepted, we're loved, we're valued, we're delighted in. And we are to show that same grace. Now let's look more deeply into what this means. Let me read again this paragraph, which to me has given me a vision of what grace is more than anything else. But let us say that now you are trying to give this grace to your husband or your child. And I'll read it, putting their name in. And you listen and see what vision, what new light this puts on how to give love, how to give grace to another. Unlike reciprocal or mutual love, this love which I give is a no-risk relationship. He, my husband, never gets to the place where my love has been discontinued because of some fault of his. He is never reduced in my eyes because of some failing. He cannot lose this love. I always continue my love toward him in spite of any tray or deed of his. There is never a time or a place where he cannot begin again. As a result, he can grow in this love without the fear and inhibition of failure. Or if we put in the name of our difficult child, and I did this, and it always brings me up short and gives me a true vision of where my direction lies. Unlike mutual human love, the love I give my child is a no-risk relationship. She never gets to the place where my love has been discontinued because of some fault of hers. She is never reduced in my eyes because of some failing. She can't lose my love. I always continue my love toward her in spite of any tray or deed of hers. There is never a time or a place where she cannot begin again. As a result, she can grow in this love without the fear and inhibition of failure. What light does this show and throw on bearing one another in love? And how can we begin to develop this kind of love? At least we have seen what it's all about. But there are some things we need to begin to do. Because although Romans 5 promises us God, the love of God shall be shed abroad in your heart by the Holy Spirit, which is given unto us. So we have hope. We can ask with confidence that God will give us this love, and he has promised. But it takes time and we have to grow. And in the meantime, can we do anything to start to begin to follow the command to love? Now, I think there are some things we can begin to do even if our heart is empty. The first thing we begin, and I say this again and repeat it, we have to practice to rest and revel in the love of God for us. And we drench ourselves in this paragraph which we have over the kitchen sink or whatever, so that we are beginning to rest in the fact that we are utterly known and utterly loved. And then as we are more rested and have a little energy to reach out in love to others because we're not hurting so much inside, and trusting that more and more of that love will be given to us as we go on in obedience, we have to make another decision. I think this has to be a deliberate decision. I came to the point, having reached this point in my search, that I was commanded to love, that I had to say to myself, I am going to be a person who reaches out in friendship from now on. And that will make us vulnerable, because sometimes we'll be rejected and sometimes we'll be pushed away. But that doesn't matter. It is the command and we obey. And I can tell you from experience that there's no doubt that 90% of the time, as you get into the habit of reaching out, you receive back so much more love than if you're sitting around in a little cocoon waiting to be loved. That's not why you do it, but it is a wonderful bonus. Now, this will be more difficult for some temperaments than others. And let us repeat what we said the other day, that there's a great contrast here between secular society and Christian attitudes. In secular society, love is an emotion that you're hungering for and chasing. And if it seemed to disappear, you feel no longer any responsibility for it, and people walk away. And this is not on for a Christian. You don't sit around waiting to be loved. You're told to go out and discover people. And love isn't just an emotion. It is an attitude and an action. I found one definition of love which I found very helpful. Love is caring enough for the other to discern that one's needs, and then caring enough to go through to try to supply them. Now, if we think about that, let me repeat it. Love is caring enough for the other to discern that one's needs, and then caring enough to go through to supply them. Now, look, do we care enough for people to work at getting to know them enough, to understand them enough, to even begin to discern their needs? Now, if you sit down and think, how many people do you know who you think really thinks that way about you, that makes the effort to get to know you enough, to understand you enough, to discern your needs? You know, I think you could probably count the number of people on one hand. And what does that say about our Christian community? You see, it's a whole new outlook of what love is. It's not just a feeling, but a direction you can take even when your heart is empty. You can begin to learn to get to know that person, to yearn and to try to understand them. It puts a different perspective on your attitude to your husband, your children, and everyone you meet. Tournier says, if you think you know your wife or husband, it is because you have given up the real attempt to discover him. There are so many hurting, lonely people in the world. Tony also says God is passionately interested in each human being. To receive God is also, therefore, to receive his intense interest for those with whom we have rubbed shoulders without really seeing them or understanding them. He says it's impossible to open your heart to God without opening your heart to your neighbour. Now, I think it's important for us to realise that deep, loving relationships at all levels we don't make with everyone. And this is not what we're asked. It would be too much. We don't have the time, and people vary in the way they are drawn to each other. So there are various levels of relationship, from the merest acquaintance to the deep, intimate friend. But even our attitude to people we rub shoulders in the street needs to be looked at. I have noticed how my husband over the years, as he's really sincerely tried to follow this command, has become a very warm person even in the supermarket. He greets a supermarket girl by name, and it's genuine. And people that he meets casually, if he has the opportunity, he will go out of his way to make a friendly and a warm and a cheery remark. And this can often make people's day, if you have this warmth, even from a stranger, especially if you're feeling low. It's a little thing, but right from that level we can look at our relationships. Let's look at the other question you were considering. How do we speak with our neighbour? How do we talk? How do we use our mouths? And I want to particularly focus on this question of how do we edify or build up? How do we impart grace to those who hear? Now, of course, the word grace again gives us the clue and sheds light on all that. We are trying to learn to value, to appreciate, and to build up and to affirm those we meet, our neighbour. And I want to ask you a question. How critical are you? Because actually, this Australian society of ours, we're knockers. We are basically very critical, competitive people. So the vision, the basic attitude to people of building up and affirming is just not part of our upbringing at all. And you notice this more if you go away to another country, like I went and lived 13 years in America and came back, and I always felt chilled a little till I got used to the Australian society again. We are basically critical. You might say, oh, I'm not. How would you like all your thoughts to be open? Now you may say, well look, does this mean I can't have any, you know, I have to sort of love everybody, I'd have no discernment about people's abilities? Now that's not what we're talking about. I think there's a difference between discernment, which is legitimate, and criticism, which is seeing people through their faults and their weaknesses. It is a way of looking at people. And we may not be aware. of how this is ingrained in us, and how if we are going to be affirmers, we will have to do a big somersault in our attitude to people. You may say, oh, well, it's silent criticism. But Jesus says, as a man thinketh, so is he. People sense how you think. I knew very well two people, both Christians. One was an affirmer and one was the reverse. Whenever I went to see my first friend, I left always feeling encouraged. She gave me the sense that she was delighted that I had come, that she valued me, that I was terrific. Now, it wasn't just for me, and it wasn't just slick flattery, it was her basic attitude to people. Now, this other person was a colleague that I worked with, and I always had the feeling that she was looking at me through my faults as if through a window spattered with dust. And this is her attitude to people. People who worked for her, there was a great turnover. She had very great difficulty in personal relationships. They were both Christians, both unaware of what they did to people. Now, affirmation is magic. And we need to work at that, to really work at, say, in the next week, each day, saying something which affirms, which encourages, which praises another. And that's not flattery. Flattery is false, but affirmation is developing the habit of seeing the good in people and developing the habit of being enriched by people, so that we're not threatened by their gifts, because we know that each of us is unique and each of us is greatly valued, and we can begin to be enriched. And to tell them so. Now let's look at anger. Be angry and sin not. Let not the sun go down upon your wrath, and leave an opportunity for the devil. I'm sure you got out of it what I got out of it, because we've dealt somewhat with anger before. What do we do with anger? Anger is an emotion which is human, but it's what we do with it that's the vital thing. Do we vent it destructively in malice and slander? Do we express it to ourselves, to God, and appropriately to another, so that we do not bury it and let the sun go down upon it? We do not brood and bury and let it destroy relationships. That is sin. We're told to speak the truth in love with our neighbour. If you have a thing against your neighbour, go to him. Now, this is very difficult. It's much easier to bury it and have no warmth to that person, or to talk about that person to somebody else. And we Christians do that all the time. I just want to talk about this buried anger in regard to our husbands. I think the most common question I have asked from patients over the years, and the commonest cry of the heart from women, is this: why doesn't my husband communicate with me? Why doesn't he share himself with me? And so often it causes deep hurt, bitterness, and retaliation in kind. And love withers. Now, the other day I was listening on the ABC of a report of a study recently, and it tells us what we all know, but it's good to hear it. that men on the whole are poor at communication skills compared to women. They find it much more difficult to open up to others, and especially in the areas of their feelings. And this is why we women often are starved for this thing that we want. And we misinterpret it. We don't realise it is a lack of skills, and we misinterpret it as a lack of love. Have you ever thought how hard it is for the men? Now, this may be partly innate, partly cultural. Certainly it is partly the pressure of the terrific competition and ruthless of the marketplace, of the outside world. But I have talked to thoughtful men who have told me they envy their wives' ability of making friends, deep friendships with other women. And they rarely have the same number of deep friendships with other men. And some of them have said, so often we turn to our wives and our homes for this sense of love and acceptance, which we don't find anywhere else. And they mightn't tell us that, but it's very precious to them. We expend so much energy often in this hidden anger and resentment. And we want to change him. But we cannot change another. The only person we can change is ourselves. And we have a calling, because our relationship with our husband is not our prime relationship. Our prime relationship is with God. And we are also bathed with love from him. And that love is to go out to others as well as into our marriage. Some women make marriage their whole world, and they stop giving out to other people as they used to. And they demand of marriage for it to supply all their needs. Now, that's not on. That's not biblical. Your prime relationship is with God. Your calling is to others. You are involved in a one flesh relationship with your husband, and as a couple you give out, and your home is a place you share with love. But that is part, it is not the whole of your life. So, again, we apply the vision of grace. And I've seen marriages turned around because instead of it becoming a dried up relationship, the wife, who has the greater ability to do this, turns around in love and gives out and gives out and gives out to her husband, to her family. And even if her heart is empty, she can start by the way of appreciation, yearning to understand, drawing out to get to know, affirmation, encouragement, building up. And that is our job within the family. And there's a lot we can do, even if our emotions are still hurting, because now we have a sense of direction. And it would be amazing how love begets love. And as before, we were spitting out in our hurt, in irritability, in tension, in anger. Now we can give out these other things, and it could be transforming. Now, I want us now to have a break. And I want you to get your pencils and pad out and to write down these questions I want you to reflect on. I want you to think about a person close to you of whom you are constantly critical. And you'll ask yourself, what are that person's strengths and lovable qualities? What are that person's weaknesses? What are that person's strengths and loving qualities? That person's weaknesses? And ask yourself, do I look at this person through his faults? Strengths and lovable qualities, weaknesses. Do I look at that person through his faults? How often do I affirm and praise him? That'll do. Now go away and come back in a quarter of an hour or whatever. Think about that as honestly as you can.
Please turn your cassette over now to side B. At this point, do not fast forward, and the address will continue on side B in a few seconds.
Interested in how to learn to love and as many practical aspects of that as we can find. Now, there are three books that I found most helpful, and I wanted to tell you a little about them. The first lot of books are by John Powell, and you've got them on your list. They are books which really help people to understand honestly how they're thinking and lead you step by step into how to learn to share yourself with others in honesty. And that's that their particular strength 10 or 20 years ago. 28 years ago, to be exact. Any parent who doesn't buy this book or share it with somebody else is irresponsible. It is an enormously practical book, and I'm going to really talk about that now. Now, Dr. Ross Campbell is a psychiatrist, a child psychiatrist, and a Christian. And he tells us that as parents, we are very poor at showing love. Now, this book is so practical that I feel it's a manual for all relationships, not just parent-child relationships. It is an enormously helpful manual for helping us to give us a sense of direction in practical ways in which we can improve our skills at showing love. Now, so often we are told over the years we should love people and no one tells us how. And this man is looking at this and he says, we're very poor at showing it. We need help. Now, we've been saying that men are poor at communication skills, but when you read this book, you won't feel very successful yourself. He says, first of all, the marriage relationship is the prime relationship in the family, and the greatest gift you can give your children is to give them the model of a warm, loving marriage relationship. Now, that is absolutely true. Don't get caught in the trap of letting the children run your family or thinking you have to put your children first. Your relationship with your husband is prime. And a good, nourished, loving relationship there is the greatest gift you can give to your children, the greatest model. And these days we need it so much. There are so many broken homes and so many damaged children because they don't have models. And many of them don't believe in love anymore, though they hunger for it. But they're becoming cynical. Now, the parent-child relationship is the trickiest in the world. We've been talking about accepting, valuing, affirming people. But with your child, sure, you can accept and appreciate and praise. But you have to train them to be civilized beings. And it's terribly difficult. Some of them are just little horrors. So how do you affirm someone that's driving you up the wall and doing all the wrong thing and you feel you've got to train them so that they won't be hurt in the world? You're walking on a tightrope. And it's very difficult. And this man is really gives a new vision of priorities here. Because he says, parents love children, but children so often do not feel loved. Now, he does help us, and I found a very much encouragement here, because he was mentioning a study where children have been investigated with great expertise and detail, and they've convinced now that some children are born difficult. No. No, that one, the back one. Yeah. Oh, oh. Now, due to all sorts of sociological and temperamental factors, which they describe in typical jargon, there is definite evidence that some children are much more difficult to handle than others. And they're born that way. Now, I had 2 out of 5. I would have loved somebody to have told me this, because we parents blame ourselves. Now, if we have a difficult child, we probably compound the problem by mishandling that difficult child because we're a normal human being and react normally. But if any of you have difficult children, then maybe you'll take comfort in the fact that if we have easy babies, if we're nurturing mothers, we'll manage all right. That is, if we are mothers who are not rejecting our children, we want our children, and we are able to make them feel accepted and loved. But if we have a difficult child and we're a non-nurturing mother, we're in for a great deal of trouble. even if we're a nurturing mother. The study didn't tell us, but I know that if you're a nurturing mother, basically, and you have a little prickly porcupine instead of a purring kitten to try and cuddle, that you can become a non-nurturing mother over the years. And so you compound the problem, and that child does not feel loved. And so you have problem after problem after problem. What is unconditional love as we give it to our children? It is loving the child no matter what. No matter what his appearance, no matter what his temperament, no matter what his performance, no matter what his behaviour. Now that doesn't mean you always have to like his behaviour or to ignore his behaviour, but you reject the deed, not the doer. And it took me a long time to realise the difference and how we miss out on that piece of wisdom. How often we reject our child and we think that is right. To show disapproval, we reject the child and we do not distinguish. We do not have ever developed the ability of saying honestly to the child, I love you, but I do not love what you're doing. That is not right. You are my loved child, but that is not right. If we can learn to distinguish between that, we would avoid so much misunderstanding, bitterness and trouble. Now this is an idea we'll never achieve, unconditional love, but it's a direction in which we can go. Now, Campbell has a marvellous model for us to think about. He says children, and I would say everybody, have emotional tanks which need to be filled. And this affects how he feels and how he behaves. If our emotional tank is full, we have a positive feeling and a better behaviour. Only if our emotional tanks are filled will a child be at his best or do at his best. Who fills the emotional tanks? Parents. The child's behaviour indicates the state of the tank. How do we fill people's emotional tanks? And 1 John 3:18, we're told, dear children, let us not love with word and tongue, but with actions and in truth. A child is far more affected by our actions than our words, says Dr. Campbell. And he says there are four areas where we affect our children enormously. And this is so practical, I find it so helpful. He says eye contact, physical contact, focused attention and listening and discipline. Now, did you know that discipline is under the whole umbrella of love? Now, he says without realizing it, we feed love to our children and to people by eye contact. He was talking about how you notice with a little baby, he's always searching with his eyes, he needs to be fed emotionally. Now, have you ever tried a conversation with somebody who keeps looking the other direction? Unfortunately, some people have no idea they're doing it. And it's terribly sad for them because it gives the impression that they are disinterested and unenthusiastic and you don't really like them and you don't enjoy being with them. It's a terribly devastating habit. And you know what he said? He said, parents are models, and if we don't give our children a lot of eye contact, They will copy us and they will be damaged in life because they won't have good eye contact with people. And you know, when I read this and I went home and I thought, I was thinking of my current difficult child, and I realised that my eye contact could be much better. You know how it is when you're a busy mother? Little work ear, little. And you don't give them enough eye contact. It's a habit we can slip into so easily if we're busy. And we're denying our child the sense and the feeling of being loved. And we often use eye contact wrongly. Sometimes we only give strong eye contact when we're approving. So we're giving them conditional love. Sometimes we use it primarily negatively when we're reprimanding. Good eye contact. And we give eye contact as a punishment. We deprive our children of our eye contact when we're displeased with them. And he says this is worse than corporal punishment. Physical touch. Oh, let me tell you something else about eye contact. It was fascinating. They did a study in a paediatric ward. And they noticed that of two children in two private rooms, because they were fairly ill, the staff seemed to go in much more to one than the other, although they went in minimally, you know, they looked after both children, and they tried to find out why. And they found that the person in one room, the child, had very poor eye contact. And so people got the impression that they weren't particularly welcome or liked, and they didn't go in so often. It's so damaging. Physical contact. Studies show that most parents touch children only when necessary. It was a bit of a shattering comment. We might think we're really good at physical contact. We're very poor at it. And not just hugging and kissing, but the little appropriate gestures of touching an arm, touching a shoulder, giving a hug, patting a head. All the things that we can develop more and more as we're alerted to this kind of need and expression. He said it has to be appropriate to age and sex. One interesting comment and study, they found that little baby girls under 12 months got 5 times the amount of physical contact and cuddling as little boys. And they found that, and they felt this was a link with this, that between the ages of 3 and adolescent, there were 5 or 6 times the amount of boys needing psychiatric help. The ratio changes dramatically at adolescence. Now, adults, there's been a lot of work done about physical contact and touch. My daughter is doing an honours thesis at the moment in this area. There was a very interesting documentary last year on the ABC about this. Some people say that we need, some studies say we need the equivalent of 12 hugs a day, and some at least 6 hugs a day to feed us, to feed our emotional tanks. We're all needy, and we all need to learn to express ourselves. Maybe the equivalent of a holy kiss is a holy hug in our society. Now, it's interesting, again, when I lived in America, where they use touch more freely, and especially in the Christian church, and my husband and I came back on sabbaticals, and we felt the great difference. So once when we came back, we said, oh, look, we will not be frozen by our culture. Let us do what we think is right as Christians and hug people more. So we behaved as we did in America. And after a while, we got the message back, what's on with Frank and Lois? So gradually we found that somehow we were affected by our environment, and we lost that ability, and that it's very difficult. You have to find a way of living appropriately in your culture and yet still giving enough physical contact to express love legitimately and with warmth. He says, we assume we're doing it, but we seldom do. He says, we must convey love to our children before anything else. Before teaching, before guidance, before example, before discipline. Their greatest need is love. Focused attention. Full divided attention is the hardest thing to get because it takes the most time. But it is vital that we make him feel he's valuable. A child should be made to feel he is the only one of his kind. Now, I want you to I wanted to share with you something which gave me a fresh vision in this area from a book, unfortunately, which is out of print, so I won't tell you about it. A wonderful book. And it's written by a clergyman, the father of six children. I have begotten them and I have reared them, but I have no comments to make and no advice to give. I do not know if I have done them good or ill. I do not know whether in their own generation they will do well or badly. I cannot even guess whether they will build because of me or in spite of me. I know only that they will build elsewhere and that here I have here no continuing city. I can barely live with my children, yet I must shortly and inconceivably live without them. I have hardly known them, hardly begun to walk the streets of their minds and the gardens of their pleasures, hardly explored with them the city that they are, and already they begin to go their ways and take my city with them. And he said this, which really stopped me. He said, one more. Delight in them openly. Speak your praise of them. Look at them with the widest eyes you can manage and don't be ashamed to be seen at wonder. You will not see their like again. What a shame if they should leave without ever knowing they have been beheld and offered up by an astonished heart. So focused attention is enormously important to try and set aside the time, especially to try and pray for ideas for parent, one child, one parent contact as much as possible. Focused attention is one of the most powerful means of keeping that emotional tank full and investing in your child's future. Are we too tired to nurture our children? Now, he talks about discipline, and I won't spend much time here because it's there in the book, except he says that love and discipline cannot be separated. And see, I think that so many people think if they give unconditional love, that means permissiveness. What do you do about discipline? Making a child feel loved is the first and the most important part of good discipline. What is discipline in child rearing? Training a child in mind and character to enable him to become a self-controlled, constructive member of society. Fine. But guidance toward the right thought and action is far superior to punishment for the wrong action. So here again, if you distinguish between the deed and the doer and be honest with your children, that you love them, but that you don't like their deed and why, you might get somewhere. Discipline is immeasurably easier when a child feels unconditionally loved. Because he wants to identify with his parents and is able to do so only if he knows he's truly loved and accepted. If a child does not feel genuinely loved and accepted, then he has real difficulty in identifying with his parents and their values. Without a strong, healthy love bond with his parents, the child reacts to parental guidance with anger, hostility, and resentment so very often. The more we keep his emotional tanks full, the more he will respond to discipline and the less it will be needed. Now, I can speak very deeply here because one of my difficult children, I was a green parent and I reacted in a normal way and we had many problems. And I used to call him a bed flinger. That is, so often I flung myself in my bed weeping, feeling inadequate to know how to deal with this child and feeling a failure as a parent. Children are so difficult, so different. The next child was one of those models that you read about that does everything right. And of course this compounded the problem with my other. My mother said to me once, she said, you know, you would have felt so smug if you just had X. You would have thought it was all due to your wonderful child rearing ability. When my difficult child was 14 and I had a friend, a wonderful friend in California that I told you about called Mary, and I was sharing with her my frustration and my anguish, and she said to me, I think that child is behaving as if he doesn't feel loved. And it was like a fist slamming my forehead. After all, here was I, my field was pediatrics. And I was a clergy wife. But I realised it was true. It is so easy to fall into that trap with one of these difficult children. The porcupine. How do you cuddle a porcupine? So I prayed for ideas. And let me say to you, it is never too late to start again. Never. Even when they're married, whatever. Never too late to turn around and start again. I had to turn around and start again. And I thought, let me build bridges of communication. What can I do with this child that we do together? And in our case, I realised that he liked World War II books. This was some years ago. I liked World War II books. So I'd race around the second-hand bookshops and find some and read a few and say, ah, he's a good book you'll enjoy. Or I'd look through the TV programmes and say, ah, there's a good World War II movie on tonight. Will you and I watch it? That was the beginning. One little bridge. I had to try and make the most of the lulls when they came, when he wasn't, you know, what they do to drive you up the wall. To grasp the lulls and somehow do some affirming. If it's any encouragement, we now have a wonderful relationship. It's never too late to start again. But it is true, when I started to turn around and concentrate on showing love, things changed. It is a small miracle, and it is the way I know And if it was our second difficult child, you would have thought that I wouldn't have fallen in the same trap again. But she was a little baby who, when she was 2 days old, was taken to Children's Hospital for a week because she was very ill. She was pummeled. She had needles stuck into her. She had tubes put in her. She was investigated from head to foot. And from that time on, she couldn't bear to be touched. And I had a child who would not be touched. I could not hug her. I could not kiss her. I could not pat her. She would shrink if I touched her. How would you deal with that problem? So, if any of you had difficult children, at least let me tell you, I understand the hurt. Now, I fell into the same trap, though I tried to avoid it, and I perhaps found it earlier. Every time I say to myself, right, it is unconditional love, it is nourishing the relationship that's important, we progress. Our relationship flourishes. And now at last she is beginning to be permitted to be touched and to be hugged and even to hug spontaneously. So it's been a long journey, but love is a creative thing. So I recommend that book. Now, I will end in a moment. Every human being hungers to be understood. No one can develop in this world and find a full life without feeling understood by at least one person. Now, you could be that person. Just one person who cares enough to reach out, accept, and try to understand is an enormously potent force for healing. Now, I know that personally. You know how often you feel, what can I do? Just one person, what can I do? I'm only one. When I was in hospital for 10 months after that experience I told you about earlier, when I was 24, my world became very small. If any of you are nurses, let me tell you, a nurse is the most potent being in a hospital. She can make or break a patient's day. A nurse can come along with a smile and a cheery remark and a feeling of caring and really lift your day. But we had a crabby sister on where I was, and my, she wrecked my day so often. One person has such potency. There was one Christian woman who used to visit this chronic diseases hospital where I was. One Christian woman. What she did and how valued she was by the patients was amazing. She cared about them and they knew it. She would go shopping for them. She would do little jobs for them. She was a Christian and she showed love. And the effect in that whole place, you wouldn't believe. Since then, I have never underestimated the power of the individual. So if the direction of your life is more and more to the understanding and affirming of people, then you will discover great riches. You will be obeying your Lord, but you will reap rich rewards. Because the richest people on earth are those who are rich in friendships. Now, I think, therefore, that I'll end this series with the hope and yearning that each of us may begin a new phase of becoming healers. To affirm, to reach out, to understand hurting and lonely people. And may this be our vision. And may we remember in a dark hour that it is not out of our strengths that we heal, but out of our acquaintance with pain. And I think I'll just end with this little chorus which never fails to move me. Something beautiful, something good. All my confusion he understood. All I had to offer him was brokenness and strife. But he made something beautiful of my life.
Before we go for lunch, ladies, Dr. Anderson's messages will be 2, 4 and 5. Those who have ordered just Dr. Anderson's messages will be able to pick them up today about 5 o'clock. Now, those who have ordered everything will pick up everything tomorrow, I'd say after you've had lunch, just before you leave. Make sure you take them with you. That means that we'll save the postage. The other thing is, the overseas department that we had last night is an extra tape. Those who have ordered full sets will automatically think that they want that tape. If they don't, will they come and see me and we'll sort that out. The other thing is, that is not included in your $20, so that will be a $3 extra charge. There's another lecture by Dr. Lois Anderson about the male and the female roles, which won't be included in this series that she's given. We have the tape available for those who would like to have it, if you let us know if you'd like to have that one or not. The other thing is, I have a Muriel Grant and a Dorothy Murray that I'd like to see before you go for lunch. All right?
Before you go, there's some comments, there's some requests from the bookstore, book lady. There were 6 books in my sample box to be sold called The Healing of Damaged Emotions by David Siemens, and apparently she only has money for 3. So if any of you ladies had gave it to anybody else, could you tell June? Now, there are some books here. Which June would like me to mention, because I did mention them in the request I gave her. One of Paul Tournier, one by Lewis Smeads, who is the best writer on the area of Christianity and sex that I know of today. If you have a daughter or a book that you need that area. I dared to call him Father and Hansie, which are marvellous books for dipping into, nourishing your soul when you don't want to be heavy, or having in hand in your bookshelves for your children as they grow up. I think I want to emphasise again that on my treasure list, there are some books that if you want to grow at all, I would yearn for you to try and get. And a lot of them were not here for sale. If you want to order some, and I will put 4 samples that I've had to draw on, but now will be available in the sample books for you to look at, to get the feel of, I'll do that immediately after this session. My particular treasures, and I'll put this in the box, Parents in Pain, Do I Have Had to Really Love My Child, David Siemens, Healing for Damaged Emotions. If any of you have any continuing and deep pain about yourself and inadequacy, this is a must, and it's very easy to read. These all should be in your libraries. Do I Have to Be Me, which has been so loved that the cover is falling off. That's one that you have to feel whether it's yours or not. One of my favourites authors, Elizabeth O'Connor, has written this book, Our Many Selves, which is a marvellous book for dipping into morning by morning as you want to walk and with God. Habitation of Dragons, particularly good for anybody, for groups and for beginners. I would suggest that if you want to order them, you go to a big Christian bookstore. If you are in the country and you're not within cooey of a bookstore, you might like to inquire of Open Book before you leave, which is at Milton. I found them very helpful in getting the most odd books that I ask for from overseas. They have a very good reputation for getting books in for you and not feeling it's too much trouble. And maybe you could inquire by the telephone before you leave as to whether they would send some to you. But those I heartily recommend. Oh, the other thing, yes. They're all Christian books. You may find How to Really Love Your Child in a secular bookshop, but these would be Christian bookshops. One other thing I want to say, and that is that I will be available until we leave on Friday, and the leaders will be available. If any of you feel that you want to talk over some of your hurts with anybody, John Powell says that sometimes just by putting things into words, it helps you to understand and see the problem more clearly. Then we would be most happy to be a listening ear. Now, we don't claim for one moment that we can give solutions, but it's sometimes a great help to share a problem and toss around options together and get a sense of direction. So keep that in mind if you would like to think about that. It is a Lutheran bookshop. Yes, a Lutheran Christian bookshop. Yes. I don't know. Might be in a church library, but they're all fairly recent. I don't know whether they would be in libraries.